wishes come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times, somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Yia Vang is a Hmong American chef born in a refugee camp in Thailand after his family fled from Laos at the end of the Vietnam War. His parents and six siblings resettled in central Wisconsin, and from there, Yia went on to college at the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse, where he met Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's very own senior grant and contract specialist, Eric Sterner. So shout out to Sterner. It's his idea that you're here, Yia.
Yeah.
College buddies. After college, Yia moved to Minneapolis, where he became a cook at the nationally decorated Spoon and Stable. From there, Yia opened up the Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, was featured on Bon Appetit on the cover in May of 2020, and today, you're also on Iron Chef. You got the world's longest resume here, Yia. It was on Food Network's Iron Chef in 2022. And that same year began hosting Feral on Outdoor Channel, which is entering its third season coming up this fall. Also in September of 23, was on the Meat Eater podcast with Steven Ranella and our friends over at Meat Eater. Coming up later this summer, Yia has a feature story in the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever Upland Super issue that has a companion video that we just got done filming. So without further ado, Yia is our featured guest on On the Wing podcast. Thanks for joining me today, Yia.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, man. It's super fun. This is my first time doing a podcast with the headphone with the little.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's my first time doing. Yeah, with the headset, which I feel like an air traffic controller. You know,
you should. That if we evolve to the ones with
the
wrist, then we'll feel like FBI. You know, we'll just talk into our wrist.
Yes. But then it looks like we're talking to ourselves if it gets over video. But yeah,
nobody will know.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. You know, it's funny, Sterner. You know, I forget his first name's Eric because throughout the college, you would just call him Sterner, right?
Yeah.
And so I remember he texted me, he goes, "Hey, this is Eric Sterner. Do you remember me?" I'm like, "Dude, yeah, I remember you. What are you talking about?" You know? And he's like, "We went to college.
We drank Keystone Light together,
right,
dude."
Right, right. He's like, "Yeah." And then, he just said, "Hey, would you, want to do something?" Like, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then... You know, you guys made me a little bit more legitimate because I talked to a few of my, buddies who are hunters. And I'm like, "You guys hear of Pheasants Forever?" And they're like, "Yeah." Like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, so we're going to be doing a project with them." They're like, "No way, really?" And I'm like, "I feel like I'm a little cooler." You know, I'm a little cooler. You know,
Cooler. I mean, you've been on Iron Chef. You have your own show on Outdoor Channel. I mean, I read a long bio, but put into your words, how we got to where we are today.
Yeah, I think... It was, we were shooting season 3 of Feral, and we were on these boats at night, and we were out frogging in the bayous near, Houston, east of Houston. And we're in the middle of the night, there's, lightning that's hit, so, we're on these boats, and we're trying to get off, and I'm laying down this boat, because we got to get off the river really fast, right, in the bayou area there. And wind's blowing in my face and it's starting to rain and the lightning's like when it hits, it flashes, and it's such a cool, beautiful scene, right? And I remember I had this come to Jesus moment where I'm like, oh my gosh, 20 years ago, if you would have told this kid from Port Edwards, Wisconsin, small, tiny, old paper mill town in central Wisconsin with 1,800 people, if you were going to tell them that, bro, one day you're going to get to travel the world, you're going to get to cook food, travel the world, and talk about your mom and dad, their history, the history of your people. Mm. Like, he would be like, "Nah, man, I'm just trying to get to college. Like, I'm just, after high school, literally that was 20 years ago when that, when I was having this moment and we're coming back into the docks and I just thought to myself, I'm like, it's, midnight or 1 o'clock or something. And I'm here in the bayous of that southern Texas, Houston area there we're out frogging, looking for bullfrogs.
Yeah.
And we're shooting the show, and there's like four boats around, and we got cameras and everything. And I just said, man, it had this. I had this appreciation thing where I was just like, it's crazy, you know. But I feel truly blessed and honored. Like, and I mean that every day, you know. Even being able to be here with you guys, you know, being able to do this project with you guys, I feel truly blessed and honored. And it's one of those things I think mom and dad just really set inside of us, where it's like every opportunity is going to come, you know, for, you know, to all the kids. They always said opportunity is going to come, you know, but, you know, just be blessed in that, you know, that you have these opportunities. And so, man, I never could imagine this outcome.
Because I've known you, like, this is the second time we've met.
Yeah.
Right. And so we've spent an hour and a half together cooking. And in that time, in the hour and a half, you talked about how fortunate you are, how blessed, how many wonderful people around you. You mentioned your parents, you know, repeatedly about how thankful you are, the way they raised you. You were just extremely likable, easy to get to know guy. I mean that in all sincerity. You have this big personality that just pops off the screen when you watch Ferrell, or, you know, you just, I study up on people I'm going to interview, right? You Instagram, YouTube, whatever. And you do have a big personality, and you kind of, the switch gets turned when the camera hits record, right? We just got done doing pheasant fried rice, tailgate style, video shoot. And you're like low key, really. And then boom, you know, showtime. But you are like sincerely appreciative of where you are.
Thank you. Yeah. I think, you know, I always go back, to my mom and dad, because, when I was younger, it was like you try to find who you are. So I grew up in Wisconsin, right? Central Wisconsin, predominantly white, small town, right? And there were some very negative things, but there were some really positive things. And I would say the positive thing about growing up in that small town was, you know, in any small town, anybody who's listening who grew up in a small town of like under 2,000 people, you know what I mean? Everybody knows everybody. Mm. Like the chief of police is like lives three doors down. So like if you got pulled over for speeding, like everybody knew.
Yeah.
He was also the ref of our football games. You know what I'm saying? So everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
I grew up in a really incredible community there where like one of my good buddies that we grew up doing sports, playing football with, his parents, were, I just jokingly called them, were my adopted white parents. You know, we could go to their house anytime. They, you know, and they always checked up on us. Even when I went to college, I would come back and I'd visit them. And stuff like that, where still today I'm getting notes from people from Port Edwards, Wisconsin. It's like, hey, we turned on outdoor and you're there, you know, chasing snakes. And it's like, I can't believe it. Like, I remember we, you know, you played football, you know, on the field here in the high school, and now you're doing this. And it just makes me feel like, wow, like there was just this really incredible supportive community. My teachers, my coaches, they really helped me believe, like, hey, your future is beyond this town. And not in a bad way. Not in a bad way. You know, I remember my old JV football coach, and he also coached me in high school. He was my history teacher, Mr. Miller, Tim Miller. He just said to me, he said, hey, man, here's the deal. When this is all done, you know, when you're graduated, this is my senior year. He said, when you graduate, I want you to leave this town and not look back. And not in a bad way where you're too good for this town, but he just said, like, your future is beyond this town. And as a kid, I didn't get that. As a 17-year-old kid, you're like, okay, coach, like, you say that to everyone. Like, you're a teacher. You have to say, that's part of your contract. Be like, inspire children. Bring, the more you know, right? And I remember the first time when we had our food trailer. This is probably like 4 years ago, 5 years ago. We had our food trailer. And on a Friday afternoon, I hadn't seen him in almost 20 years. Like, Coach Miller and his wife surprised me by walking up to our, you know, our little first spot in this food trailer by, you know, Sociable Cider Brewery. And I just see him and his wife, and I'm like, oh my gosh, Coach Miller, like, I haven't seen him in 20 years. And I remember we just sat down, got a bunch of food for them, sat down, ate, and I was able to express all that to him.
That's
like,
awesome.
You believed in a kid where, like, you didn't know what the potential was. He was like, well, I just knew you guys, you know, you were going to, you kind of were going to go beyond this. And this is what I tell a lot of high schoolers. I've been very blessed to be able to go to high schools and speak to high schoolers, and this is what I tell them. I said, you know, you're going to be growing up, you know, and if we have young people or high schoolers listening, like, you're going to be growing up. And when you grow up, there's going to be all these great people around you. There's going to be some mean people that are going to say some really bad stuff too. Just brush that aside. But you're going to get a few people who are going to encourage you. It could be a parent. It could be grandparents. It could be friends. It could be a coach. It could be a teacher. They're going to encourage you. They're going to believe in you. I want you to take that and think of it as like equity and create a little piggy bank in your heart. And you put that in there. You put that in there. Because when you go from high school, you have all these people that in your life that they believed in you. And you take that little equity and you put it in your heart. One day you're going to make, there's going to come a point in your life. You can be in your 30s. You can be in your 40s. You're going to have to break that bank. Take all that equity, all that savings, and you got to go bet on yourself. And to me, this isn't yeah doing all of this. No. This is for those who believed in me when I was 15, 16, not knowing what I wanted to do. You know, when I was lost in college, not knowing who I was. These are the people who, you know, put that that equity, you know. And that's what I tell young people, man. Like, you're going to experience a lot of things, especially high school, middle school, you know, young kids.
Yeah.
It's going to seem like the end of the world. And you and I'm 40. I'm not sure how old you are. But
a little bit older.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That stuff in 10, 15 years is not going to mean anything, to be honest.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're going to – but there's
going to be – but it means the world to you at that moment, right?
Yes, it does. It does.
It just cascades on
you. Yeah, but you're going to have people in your life that's going to believe in you and say, hey, you got this, kid. I'm behind you. And then you just save that up. And that's how we were able to kind of do the things we were, where it was just like, I don't know if I can do this, but, man, I have an army of people behind me, you know, and that equity that they put in there, like – you know, one of my favorite movies is Saving Private Ryan, right? Mm-hmm. You've seen it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and the way the whole movie is set up, you think that it's Captain Miller, like from the beginning, you know, with the older gentleman he's in, you know, he's out there, he looks over that grave, and you think that's Captain Miller, but at the end, it's actually Private Ryan, right? Mm. And what does Captain Miller say to him with his last dying breath? You know, he says, earn this. And then the first thing, you know, goes back, and, you know, Private Ryan now is this old grandpa in his 70s, and he looks at his wife and he looks at his kids, and what does he say? He looks at his, honey, have I lived a good life? And he's reflecting on the fact that all these people died to come save me, to get me out.
Yeah.
You know, like, what does this mean? And I in a good haunting voice, I hear that, and that's the echo of my grandfather, who I never met, fought in this war, died in this war. Mm. You know, my uncles, some of them who I've never met, fought in this war, died in this war to get us the freedom. To all the teachers and coaches that put in those extra hours. To, you know, Coach Miller, who during his prep hour, where the last thing he wants to do is have some kids sit around in his class and ask him life questions. He sat there with me. Yeah. You know, to Ms. B, who was my Spanish teacher, who always believed in me. You know, but I had a C in Spanish. I wasn't good in Spanish. You know, but she believed in me. And in my yearbook, I think she wrote down, you're an amazing student. You have great potential. Like, in high school, I was a quiet kid. You know, when you're like one of the like four Hmong kids in a predominantly white school, like, you're kind of quiet. You know, like, I did sports, some extracurricular. I wasn't smart enough to get a lot of scholarship, but I'm like, oh, I'm a big dude. I can like knock people around, so maybe I'll play football or whatever. You know, and I remember she wrote in my yearbook. It says, "One day you're the person I believe that one day I'll flip on the TV and you'll just be there."
Wow.
And the first time we were able to be on national TV with a show from CNN, I remember I cut and pasted that photo, and I DM'd her, and I said, "Hey, Ms. B, like, if you turn on CNN at this time, at this, you know, like, you know, you get to see this."
Yeah, that's,
you know, and so stuff like that, you know. And, man, truly, this is where I do feel honored and blessed to be able to do all this, because of those who have taken their time, who have sacrificed their time, all of it, from grandma to grandpa to mom, dad, to teachers, to coaches. You know, and that's, I don't know, but it took me a while to get there.
Sure.
You know, like, my 20s were like, yeah, I'm going to go find myself. And I hated the fact that I was Hmong.
Because really?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Like, that, it was horrible. Like, imagine, like, always knowing that you look different all the time. Mm. You know, that's what I tell people. Imagine if everywhere you go, you know you look different. Or even when people find out you're Hmong, people want to connect. I think, with a good heart, they want to connect. Mm-hmm. But every time they find out you're Hmong, they're like, oh, my gosh. Like, when I was 5 in kindergarten, there was a Hmong kid in our class. His name is Chang. And that's it. And you're like,
yeah. do you know him?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And you're like, cool.
Yeah.
Like, when I was five in kindergarten, this guy named Billy, he's a white kid. Do you know him? Like, do you see how, like, you know? Yeah. And so, like, having to answer that or, oh, what are you? That's the thing. What are you?
Yeah, and then when you say Hmong,
they're like, well,
so many people have no idea, right?
Yep. Or, well, Hmong, I've never heard of that country. Because it's always associated with the country. Right? We're a countryless, you know, people group. Like a lot of other people group out there. There's a lot of people group that that live, that they're from certain countries, but like they're ethnically different, you know?
Mm.
And so some people just don't get that. And so I always feel like I had to defend my position of why I'm here. You know, like, oh, you guys are refugees. Like, it was so great that America took you guys in. It was like, well, yeah, hold on. Our people fought with the Americans, then got left behind after they pulled out the lost Saigon in 75, you know? And then after that, they had to fight for another 5-6 years before the Refugee Relocation Act that was put in place in Congress by 1980. And then we could start rolling in. But when you rolled in, like, as refugees, it was like, well, we can only take a little at a time, you know? And so, you know, from 77 to 88, almost 11 years, my parents were in this refugee camp, Vinai.
Mm.
Yeah, and then so I was born there in 84, and we left in 88.
And where was the camp at?
So the camp is it's no longer there. It's just a big flat piece of land that's, you know, it was taken down in 92. It was like, you know, but it's saying kind of northern Thailand where where Laos and Thailand hits, you know.
And how did your parents come to pick Wisconsin, or did they not pick Wisconsin?
So we actually came because it's like a weird geopolitical thing, right?
Hmm.
You can't come into this country as a refugee unless you have sponsors here or, you know, or family. Well, okay. If you're a brand new group of people,
sure.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
if there's no Hmong family here, like, who's going to then sponsor? So a lot of Methodist and Presbyterian and Catholic churches that worked with nonprofit refugee relocating nonprofits are one of the biggest one is here in the Midwest, here in the Twin Cities.
Okay.
So it was a lot of the churches, you know, out in the Burbs area around here, Plymouth, Wayzata, a lot of the churches that, you know, that worked with different charities. What they would do is families would sponsor Hmong families.
Mm-hmm.
So once they had the Hmong families come in and they were able to get on their feet, then they themselves can sponsor other families, you know, other part of their families.
But
to come in.
But your family even took it like a step further into central Wisconsin. How'd they end up there?
Yeah, and it was just kind of scattered,
okay.
Right?
Huh.
So, for example, we first came in here. We ended up here in Eastside St. Paul, and then we ended up in Appleton, Wisconsin, Menasha, Manitowoc area.
Yep. Nina.
Yep, all that. That's why there's a lot of Hmong people over there on that side.
Okay.
You know, so you kind of did that. And then Dad wanted to move us out east for a little bit. So we found some friends and family that were out in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. So so growing up from my elementary years, from, you know, kindergarten all the way to eighth grade, I grew up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. So my neighbors were Amish, Mennonite. And when I say Amish, I mean like Dutch Amish. Like, like these are like the Pennsylvanian Dutch. Like this is, you know, different kinds of you know, they're just different
groups.
Like
no electricity Amish?
Oh, yeah, dude. You go. I mean, there was all branches of like it's okay to have phones, but the phone has to be outside of the house. So for some families, some Amish families, there was literally it looked like a phone. You know, it's like a. Like a payphone outside on their driveway. It has to be a certain distance, you know, from the house. You know, for some of them, it was like no electricity. So everything was kerosene, you know, fire little, you know,
lamps
and stuff like that. You go all the way from that to Mennonites, you know, where it's like, yeah, we can have a car or we can do this or, you know, and they're different. So I just thought that was normal.
Yeah,
like,
you experienced a lot of different.
Yeah. And then, you know, eighth grade, we moved back to central Wisconsin where my dad's side of the family, all his brothers lived there.
Huh.
So a very small town. It was a paper mill town, you know. So Wisconsin Rapids, Port Edwards, Wisconsin's all paper mill, you know. You know, I mean, the paper mills are stinky, you know.
I grew up in Escanaba, Michigan.
Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about.
It smells like rotten eggs when they're doing certain things.
Yep. And There were shirts you can buy that said, "Does somebody fart? Or are we in Port Edwards?" there were shirts you can buy there too.
Did you own one?
No, yeah. But like I kind of like outside of that area.
Yeah.
People don't get that joke. Yeah, like, yeah. It's like nah. You know, even like Appleton area. You know, there's a bunch of paper mill around that area. Anything that's near a river. You know, because the Wisconsin River comes right through Wisconsin Rapids and Port Edwards, there in Nacoosa, and you know, so there's a lot of paper mills in there. So my parents and we ended up there. I did my high school years there, and then went to college at UW La Crosse, you know. And
what did you study when you were at La Crosse?
So I wanted to study, I had no vision of anything. I was like, well, maybe I'll be a teacher. Well, a gym teacher would be fun because, like, we get to sit in the weight room and just, like, throw weights around and, sure. You know, peg kids with balls, you know. So I started that out, and I was like, man, there's actually a lot of things you got to know, you know. And then I kind of just I dropped out of college for a little bit and I started cooking, you know. I had that cooking background. So okay. I'm like, my thing was, I always joked about, I'm like, if everything fails, I can get a job $10 an hour cooking somewhere. Like I was decent enough and fast enough and I lived a pretty clean life, you know. And so it's like, I didn't have to worry about like, oh, like, you know, when they hire me, it wasn't like, oh, one, like, you know, what if we need to bail him out of jail or he had a crazy night and blah, blah. So it's like, so all the chefs that worked for loved me. They're all like, oh yeah, like, we know you get in here on time, you know? And really quickly I found out in the restaurant world, I'm like, wait a minute, these guys still have jobs, but they're not here on time. Like, I'm here on time, right. You know? And so I was decent at that. And then I cooked for a while. It was very important for my parents that we get that all their children get a college degree. And I'm just not a classical learner. Like, if I read something, I'm like, okay, what does this mean? Like, but like, if you can give me something to touch with my hands, you know, like, you know, and then I can work it with my hands. Like I can see, like, oh, this is how it works, you know. So cooking made sense for me.
It you know, just watching you cook on this little, butane grill, you can see that it makes sense to you. And it also pulls out this creativity that I feel like is inherent inside of you too.
Well, the crazy thing is in our world, in the Hmong culture growing up, that just means you're like cooking.
Uh-huh.
That's just a skill everybody has.
Okay.
There's no such thing as art of it. There's no such thing as a skill. And that's just like, who doesn't know how to cook? That's called life. So there wasn't any value in that. So it was, you know, your classic education, you know, you're going to work in business, you're going to work in finance, you know, you're going to be a doctor, lawyer, right? And look, I'm not mad at my parents for focusing on that. Because when they came to this country, they know that those are the jobs that are going to move you up the social ladder where you're going to get money and you're going to get security. So when you come from poor countries where you have nothing and you're in the mountains and the technology in the mountain, still today, you know, last spring I went there, we shot a show up in the mountains of Laos with some Hmong villages up there. It's still the same technology 50, 60, 70 years ago. Yeah, they're barely past the Bronze Age. You know, they're making their knives out of old planes that crashed there.
No kidding.
From the war. Yeah. And then they'll take the metal and then they'll heat it up and they'll weld it into knives, into machetes that they can use on the farm or backhoes that they use on the farm. You know, they're also using like all these ornaments that didn't explode. They cut them in half and they become these like pit fires, you know, where they grill out of and they cook out of.
Wow.
Like
very utilitarian.
That was 2023. That was a year ago or whatever, you know? So it's not like, so you go from that and having nothing and that when you want water, if you are one of the very lucky villages, you got a well and everyone uses that well. And when you do dishes, everybody in the family, they just bring all their dishes down there and they do the dishes down there. You know, you want water to drink? Well, you better make sure that that's safe. That's 2003.
Right.
2004. Oh, I'm so sorry. 2023. 2023, 2024. Like, this isn't like, oh, yeah, back in 1800s, we did. Right. No.
So it makes working an 18-hour day at the restaurant seem no big deal.
Nothing. Because for what mom and dad had to go through, you know, aunts and uncles, my parents, my family that lived in these mountains had to go through. You can't clock out of life. So when I was younger and they're like, hey, we want you to focus on this, make sure you do well in school, like get good grades. We saw it as well, mom and dad just doesn't understand. You know, so you fight against that, you know, because like you have this Western mentality. I want to be independent. I want to be free. I want to choose what I want to do. You know, like don't tell me who I can be. That's a very Western mentality, right? Individualism. And as I got older, And I realized, and especially for me, when I hit the age of when my father brought us to this country in his early 30s, I go, what had I done with my life? And it hits me hard. When I turned 30, I was like, dang, by the time Dad was 30, he fought a war. He started when he was 12, little child soldier. He fought a war, lived through a camp, had his family, brought him to this country, started with nothing, no ounces of English, just started working, just started hustling, just started working. Dad is great with his hands, so he ended up, when we were living out in Pennsylvania, he started being a woodworker. So he built kitchen cabinets. That's what he did. And then when we moved to central Wisconsin, he became a welder. So he built tractor trailers. And then he eventually, you know, got a job like being a, you know, working with a contracting group that, you know, build homes. And he, that's what he does. He works with his hands. And so it hits me. I'm like, I'm 30 and I'm kind of like, oh, hopping from this job. Oh, maybe I'll do this. Maybe I'll do this. And that was my, you know, my big moment where I'm like, what am I doing with this? You know, and then it, that, you know, in the midst of all that too, we did a lot of, you know, I worked at all these amazing restaurants, learned a lot of cool stuff, you know, graduated and went back to college, graduated with a degree in interpersonal communication and a minor in PR and marketing. And I thought I could take my skills in the nonprofit world and save the world. And I'm like, oh man, college loans. It's like, wait, but can we? So it's like,
testify, brother.
So it's like, how can we pause these college loans until the world is saved? You know, then ended up, just ended up working in kitchens again. And then from there, I have a very, you know, my family was like, look, I think they knew I was into the restaurant thing, but I don't think they knew what I was doing. So they're like, okay, cool. Like, you can do this. And my brother was amazing. He's like, just come stay at our house. Don't worry about rent. And then we were able to start really slow, you know, hopping from event to event. You know, I had a RAV4 that had 300,000 miles on it. And we just take that bad boy wherever we needed. And we just popped up from here to there. And then eventually just kind of grew from there.
You talked about a little bit ago a moment where you bet on yourself. I guess, was there a specific moment where you opened up that, you know, all those people that believed in you and you cracked that inside your heart and you said, I'm putting all the chips in the center of the table?
So I, in a gambling way, I guess, if you want to call it down, it's not one big moment, but you're going to have multiple moments. And it's going to be like, here's a big bet. Okay, wow, that turned out great. That gives you confidence for another big bet. So honestly, it started with Social Society Works. The owners over there said, hey, you know, you guys come here, set up your tent once in a while. We're going to get a trailer. We're going to get a food trailer. We have no business in, you know, trying to do food. Do you guys want to do the residency in here? Okay, great. This is the first time. Because we've been just doing pop-ups, going for using other people's restaurant.
So for folks that are listening that aren't in the Twin Cities, Sociable Cider Works is a biggest cider brewery in probably the state of Minnesota. Hard cider.
And it probably, well, what worked really well was a lot of our food is gluten-free, which, like, we don't mean for it to be. Like, we're not like, hey, we're gluten-free. We just, a lot of Asian food, it's rice-based, right? So it's gluten-free. Dairy-free, too. So a lot of coconut milk, not a lot of, you know, butter or milk. And cream. So that worked well with their clientele, because a lot of their clientele are either dairy-free or gluten-free because it's cider, right? It's not beer. And so one day, like, for example, one day all the cooks, we were kind of hungry. So we're like, okay, we got this, like, chicken thigh in here. What do we have around here so we can batter and just fry some chicken? And we're like, oh, we got tapioca flour. Oh, we got tapioca flour, or we got some rice flour. And then it's like, well, we need a wet batter. So we're like, in Sociable, we became really good friends with them. So in Sociable, they had all the dented cans where they just give away. So we're like, go grab like four dented cans of the, you know, of the one of the ciders. And we just like, oh, we're going to make like a beer batter with this. And then we just like kind of, you know, mixed it and threw in some seasoning. And then we deep fried it for the cooks to eat. And then we like gave it to some of the, you know, staff. We're like, hey, you guys want to try some of this fried chicken? And they're like, oh, that's really good. What's the deal? And I'm like, well, how'd you guys, like, is it gluten-free? I'm like, oh, yeah. Like, we forgot about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, it is gluten-free. And then I remember then one of the, I think one of the staff told one of the diners, or one of the, you know, people that were coming in, and goes, oh, they have like gluten-free chicken. And people started going, oh, what's this? I heard this like fried chicken thing's gluten-free. And we're like, oh yeah, we've totally forgot about that. Yeah, it is. And so like, it was just like, oh, here's some fried chicken you know, that you guys are doing that we're really loving. And, you know, at that time, the whole fried chicken sandwich craze was like really growing. It's like a fried chicken. You know, that, but I say that the first time we really betted ourselves was moving into that spot.
Gotcha.
You know, so we had to get like, I think it was like $3,000 to kind of buy supplies, get these things. Because before that, it was like I left some stuff in my brother's garage. I left some stuff in my uncle's garage, had some stuff in the back of my car, and we travel. And then when we need to gather stuff, we gather all these things. And then I start my buying early in the morning. And I would go to like Restaurant Depot or Costco and just be like, okay, we'll buy all this at, you know, 8 in the morning. And then we go prep and then execute. You know, that's what it was. It wasn't – so your days, you know, start 6 in the morning and it ends at midnight. So you're just like, yeah, whatever. This is normal.
Yeah.
You know, I remember one time we had this little catering kitchen we worked out of Eastside St. Paul. And it was just kind of in this little, like, you know, shadier part of town. And it was like in February. It was cold, icy. But then we had to do like – and then we start picking up catering jobs in between, right? And it was like an early morning, like – up in New Hope, Minnesota, like a women's church brunch, you know, where we're making French toast for them and quiche, which is like, when you start like that, you'll take any gig. A couple $100, like, yeah, we'll go. I remember I was walking in, I was carrying a bunch of heavy stuff. It was like 5 in the morning because we had to be there by 10, you know, get their brunch going. And I slipped on the ice. And I remember when I slipped on the ice, I thought to myself, please slip on the ice and hit your head on the ground so then, like, you don't have to do this. Because I was just, like, tired. It was, sure. You're just so tired that week. And I'm like, please, please. But then, like, when I slipped and fell on the ground, I hit my shoulder first before my head hit, which was a saving grace. But I'm like, ah, darn it. You know? Like, I'm still capable of getting up. Yeah. You know? And I remember those days. I tell that story to say, oh, that's not sexy. Like, none of that's sexy. And then being able to go to the trailer. And then from the trailer there, COVID hit hard. While we were at the trailer, we were able to take a bunch. We did this campaign to build out V9. And this is like 4 years ago.
So V9 is the restaurant that you're getting ready to open.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. So we started saying, hey, what would it look like if we, you know, built out a restaurant? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, we're like a bunch of mercenaries. Like, you know, you put stuff in a truck, you go somewhere, we can set up and take down. But, like, to have a home, you know, it's like going from, you know, renting an apartment with 5 dudes to, like, being a homeowner and being like, oh, the water heater's not working. Yeah, that's a landlord issue. Well, you're the landlord. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, stuff like that, you know? And so, you know, had some people come around and said, hey, how do we do this? So we started this GoFundMe campaign, Kickstarter campaign. And again, that's another betting on yourself. I'm like, who would want to give money for this? You know, so I had friends who were incredible producers and said, hey, I'll come make a video for you. Huh. We'll make it beautiful. And so my buddy, you know, Tristan, you know, a good astronaut production, he goes, I'll do it and I'll give you a friends and family discount because I believe in what you're doing. And so we made this incredible video. We were able, by that time, the press was, you know, really loving. We finished the Kickstarter, and the way the Kickstarter works is, like, if you don't get all the funds that you target to raise, you don't get any of the funds.
Gotcha.
So you have to get all of it. So we're like, okay, our goal was 75,000. Sorry, 75,000 was our goal. Well, we hit 96,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when we finished it off, and then after that, 96, we had friends who were like, look, because, you know, Kickstarter takes their percentage. You know, that's just how business works. They're like, hey, we want all this to go to you. So unofficially, like, we broke 100,000.
Oh, wow.
So they're like, well.
So you had friends cover the portion that Kickstarter took.
And just saying, well, we'll straight up write a check to you guys.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying?
And this was right as COVID started?
So COVID started, and we're all like, oh, yeah, it's a cold. Everyone, calm down, everyone, right? Literally, when we finished the Kickstarter was done. We finished. We had a big, you know, wrap-up party. The next week, all restaurants closed.
Oh,
they closed everything. So we're like, shoot, what do we do? And then this is the other bet on yourself. We went pure, like, takeout only from this food trailer. And the community came around and said, look, we're going to help support. You know, we had friends that knew we were restaurants that were saying.
And this is the Union Monk Kitchen.
Yep. And this is still the trailer at Sociable. Yeah. And, I mean, we had no platform. So it'd be like, if you go to our website, you can buy, like, T-shirts and, like, sauces on there. Mm-hmm. Well, we just quickly went on there and just wrote a menu on there. It says, oh, by the way. Like, it's an e-commerce thing where it's like, Yeah, you can also order food.
Yeah.
Wow. We had no idea what we were doing, and people were just, okay, we're going to, you know, order from you guys, order from you guys, order from you guys. And then all of that happened, plus, you know, uprising, rioting, all that stuff. It was just like a 1-2 punch, but then it's just like, okay, we gotta believe in ourselves. And again, bet a little bit more, you know? And then eventually from there, we were able to go to a bar and grill. And so we like, okay, we're going to bet on this. So this is bar and grill. We're getting ready. I think it was like $25,000. We took to go in that bar and grill. The bar owner was going to do the drink side, and then we just cover all the food.
Mm.
It was a great deal, right? 6 weeks in, there was the second close shut down.
Oh, wow.
We thought we were done again. I'm like, we got no more money for this. And then there was a person who was a big fan of ours who said, hey, I have this big catering kitchen. Why don't you guys just come out of there?
Huh.
So literally after the 6 weeks, we had a great push on our Thanksgiving kit dinner. Because at that time, everybody was doing kits, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they did a kit dinner. That gave us enough money to float for a couple weeks while we transitioned to this catering kitchen.
Wow.
You know, out in St. Paul. And then we're pumping from there for almost a year. And then we were very blessed while we're in there. You know, COVID's starting to go down. Everyone's starting to feel a little better. But people are still feeling weird about going inside.
Yeah.
So we did our best. We were able to do start doing, like, in-home things. You know, again, you know, people were gathering. So we would go outside and do, like, you know, put together dinners for them outside and stuff like that. And
so we've talked long line of your cooking background,
mm-hmm.
right, in restaurants. So now I want to weave in mm-hmm. the hunting
component, yeah, yeah.
right? So, and where feral comes into yep. that, because all this is happening in parallel, right? Or at least part of it.
Yes.
So let's start with your hunting background, because my assumption, you know, in folks that I'm friends with in mm-hmm. in the monk community, mm-hmm. Andre Zhang, who mm-hmm. I train dogs with, mm-hmm. and Ken Yang, who's been mm-hmm. on this podcast, their perspective, well, hunting is part of the monk culture. It's like, mm-hmm. it's, the way you articulated cooking, like everybody can cook.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, like everybody kind of grows up hunting. Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. your experience as well?
Yep. Hunting and fishing to us is like going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, imagine, you know, some kid, like it'd be crazy for, you know, some, you know, non-monk kid who's like, yeah, I went to the grocery store and I bought groceries. It's like, yeah, it's like hunting and fishing for us. It's like you go on Saturday mornings. And it's depending on who your dad is or, you know, especially who your dad and uncles are. Like, they're serious, dude. They're like, look, our limit is 50 for panfish. Every kid that's coming, you're going to catch 50, okay? Like, it's like, we're not here just to build memories. It's like, no, we're here to do this. And then we take it home, we clean them, and then we freeze them, and that's going to get us through.
That's food.
Yeah. Like mm-hmm. that's part of – that's in our DNA, you know? Hunting and fishing and being outdoors, our people did that. Like, you go to the mountains of Laos – that's what they do. You know, kids go jump into the river and they go spearing for fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as simply as, you know, your mom going, hey, buddy, here's $5. Can you run to the convenience store and grab some eggs for mom? Right. It's like, hey, buddy, grab your spear, go down to that little river, jump in there and pull out a few fish for us. Yeah. That was just like so much cooler for kids. Like, imagine your job is to look like a Navy SEAL with a little goggle and a little spear gun. You jump in the, it's just like, dude, come on, man. What kid doesn't want that kind of childhood, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we grew up doing that. It was normal. It was normal to see small game on the dinner table, squirrels, rabbits. It was normal that, oh, you know, one of my uncles got a deer and we all go over and we help break it down, and then we either divide the meat or make it right there. You know, it was normal that all our protein, all our meats, chicken, pork, beef, comes from a farmer where you go, okay, that one. It's kind of like how you pick your lobster, that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, have a few of your cousins, uncles, and, you know, you guys go out there and you know, the word is harvest, but I call slaughter because mm-hmm. that's really what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's completely normal. That's part of our childhood growing up. Now, as a monk kid growing up, you don't talk about that to your white friends at school when you go to school, because they're going to look at you and go, that's so weird. Why are you guys so weird?
Mm.
So you keep that in your heart, and you only talk around about that with all your other Hmong friends, or even when you're around your other Hmong friends. You know, as a kid growing up, you kind of just know that, oh, yeah, well, we don't do, you know, Y basketball, you know, or like, you know, YMCA sure, basketball, sure. Or we don't do Little League on Saturdays or soccer on Saturdays. You know, why don't we do that? Because we're up at 6 in the morning going with dad to this farm that's an hour away, and he's got a deal on 2 hogs, and we're going to go help him break him down, bring it back, and we're going to wrap it up, and that's going to be our meat for the next month.
Mm.
You know, like, you don't we didn't grow up going to swim camp or all these camps, you know. And so you just felt like you were weird, you know, and even in the hunting and fishing world, you know, it was fun. It was great memories, you know, but it wasn't like a, hey, let's build memories with grandpa and dad and on a boat somewhere, you know. It's like we were poor. We didn't have boats. So what do? You wade in the water. You know, you go to rivers and lakes where you know that there's a spot where dad has kind of scouted out and he tells you throw it that way. Use this lure. You know, hunting, it's like, okay, dad's going to take you hunting. You got to go sit still with him and, you know, watch the squirrels as they come. You got to be quiet, you know. You know, deer hunting.
Everything. You grew up hunting everything as a kid.
Yeah, we did. We grew up hunting, you know, and it was normal to see this on our dinner table.
Yeah.
So when they approached me about the show about feral, I was just like, oh, yeah, you mean being Hmong? Like, that was the thing I said to the producer.
So who approached you? How does that come to be?
Yeah, so Intuitive Production, which is a production company owned by Andrew Zirn. Their producer, the two Patricks, they had two Patricks there. We just call them the two Patricks, or Patrick McMahill and Wyland. McMahill calls me, and, you know, we've done some pilots before.
Okay. When you mentioned Andrew Zimmern, who's also Minneapolis.
Yep.
So he's had all kinds of shows on
Bizarre
CNN.
Foods. Yeah, everything.
Like, so you and Andrew knew each other from the food community?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. You know, like we would do different events that he would host and he'd come over and say hi and stuff like that. And so it wasn't like we were like buddy-buddy, but like we like just knew each other's, you know, mutual respect and, you know, what we do. And he, you know, so he was, you know, so he... But it was more on his producer side.
Gotcha.
Say, you know, Wyland and McMahill. And McMahill calls me one day and goes, hey, man, we've done a few pilots with you, and we really think that we have this idea. He goes, I have this wild idea. I just want to throw it out there to you. And he's like, what if we travel the country, like, finding invasive animals or animals that are, you know, are destroying the ecosystem, or even just animals that most people won't eat, and let's hunt them down. And you go out with a guide and you hunt them down with the guide, and then the second part of the show is like, you know, you enter their world, and then the second part of the show is they enter your world and you cook together.
Wow.
And he goes, what about that? And I'm like, yeah, it's called being Hmong, bro. Like, yeah. Sure. Like,
not a stretch for me.
Yeah. I'm like, bro, that's what my uncles do, you know? That's what my dad, that's what we do. Like, you know, like, you want to clear bullfrogs out of a little lake? Like, send the Hmong dads and uncles in there, dude. They'll clear that lake out real fast in one night, you know? This is their childhood, you know? You want to, you got squirrels, like, you know, pestering this certain part of your farm? Yeah, we'll get you in there, you know? And so it was... And that was like a year and a half process, you know, because I think people think like, oh, you get a show and right away it flows. It's like, no, there's like production. There's a lot of, you know, it's like, I got to jokingly tell people, it's like going on a blind date. You don't know what's going to come out of it. It could be like, hey, crew, we're going to be friends, or, oh, great. You know, and you bump into each other, goes, hey, we went on that coffee thing once, you know. It's like, you know, and then they called and they said, hey, Outdoor wants to pick this up. Like, you know, you ready to roll? And I'm like, oh, sure. And in the midst of that, we also have a show with PBS called Relish, you know. So it's in the metro area, but I go to different kitchens, different chefs, different cooks, and then really learn the story behind the foods. You know, it could be one ingredient, it could be a dish from their family, and really dig into that. And so that was kind of starting a little bit, and it was these little, like, you know, it started out as 6 to 10 minute vignettes, you know, like online. And then in the midst of that too, Food Network reached out and said, hey, we have this little, like, mini, like, on, you know, online YouTube, you know, kind of section where we want to fill out, and we want to call it Stoked, where it's all wood fire cooking. So, you know, get you down to, like, you know, like a place like Florida, and there's a really beautiful ranch, and we're like, we just want to do like a 4-episode, and then we want to talk about Hmong food and why fire cooking with Hmong food is important, you know. And that resonated inside of me, because it's outdoor and it's, you know, you're cooking with fire. And I think a lot of those helped piece to kind of have outdoor, you know, the executives from Outdoor who are like, who is this kid?
Yeah.
You know, who are Hmong people? Who is this kid? And then they kind of said, oh, well, we can kind of see this, you know, working. And even I tell people the sizzle reel, or the audition reel for Feral was, I went to this like park in Edina or Eden Prairie somewhere, and it's like this little park where it's like, you could tell it's a park, but if you look at it from a certain angle, it looks like we're in the woods. and I had this like makeshift grill, and I was like grilling like meat on it, and, you know, talking about outdoors cooking and fire and stuff like that. And McMahill, one of the producers, had like two camera phones and just like video me. And I'm like, huh, this is how I'm starting my career in this. Hey, me and by the van by this park.
Right.
And I have a camera phone. I'm going to video you while you cook with this low cut apron on. So that's how I felt. I always make fun of him about that. I'm like, it's the shadiest thing we did. It was like, and it's during my lunch break. You know, that was, it was literally during his lunch break while he was, you know, at the studio producing. And I'm like, hey, he's like, okay, go stand over there. I'm like, okay. You know, just a, you know, just this, you know, small town kid from central Wisconsin, you know, saw the big city and, you know, that's how I felt. And then, yeah, they called in. And then that was another process too. They called in and said, hey, like, let's go. And so I thought there was going to be a pilot that was going to be shot, and they said, you know what? Right away, we want to order 8 episodes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. Huh. And, man, that first day was a learning curve. Like, I've done a lot of what we call, like, dump and stir shows, where it's like you stand before a camera and you're just like, hey, you know.
Kind of what we did today, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's very controlled, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I've done a lot of, like, hosting, but it's like, it's like I'm talking with the guests and then even to camera and a lot of voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
That's completely different from traveling where it's like, yeah, nature doesn't work with you.
Right.
You know, and you will be in situations where you're like, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, and that's kind of how it started. Our first episode, season 1, episode 1 was Destin, Florida, lionfish.
Hmm.
And you have to scuba dive. I'm not scuba surfing, so I didn't do it, but the two guides are worth it. You go 100 meters down into this coral area and you spear, you know, spearfish. And those guys were incredible.
Wow.
We were out. And so you got to remember, this was like mid-May. So mid-May in Minnesota is like 50 degrees, mm-hmm. 40, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Mid-May down in Destin, Florida is like 98. You know, like people are coming down there for vacation already.
Spring break.
So I'm going from 50, like whatever, I'm wearing like a pullover sweater, whatever, to like I'm in shorts and cutoffs, and it's like we're on the middle of the ocean, like, you know, like an hour off the coast, and it's like boom, boom, and the boat's hitting hard, and I'm just like, you know, and I'm just like, I did not drink enough water. So at one point I was laying there, I was like, it's just like Gatorade. I'm like, electrolytes, you know, and like the sun is beating on us. So, you know, our like most of our crew, like our body wasn't ready, you know, to take on that heat. So, and we go right from there to wild boar hunting in that area.
Wow.
You know,
so I mean, again, your introduction's like 3 paragraphs long, mm-hmm. right? And you've been on the cover of Bon Appetit.
Yeah, to clarify on that, the steak we made was on the cover. So okay. When people say
your
that,
your feature story.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. But I always, people always say, oh, so we looked and we couldn't find it. I'm like, oh, a piece of meat was there.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Well,
yeah,
but something you created on the cover of the most renowned food publication.
Yeah.
You've got multiple TV shows, multiple restaurants at your work. Yet, you know, when Pheasants Forever, when we called you and said, mm-hmm. hey, would you do a story, mm-hmm. do a video? You're like, mm-hmm. absolutely. The missing piece that I want to get more involved in is mm-hmm. conservation.
Mm-hmm.
You jumped right to that.
Yeah.
That's really important to you.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So I learned a lot about what conservation means, especially from a lot of my friends who are, you know, pheasant hunters. In college, my good buddy Ryan Lamp, right? He was my I always jokingly tell people, and he's still a good friend now. We've known each other for 20 years now, and it's crazy to say that. We're like, man, we're old, dude. Like, we've known each other for almost 20 years. And so his father, Jim Lamp, is, you know, they're big fans of, you know, Pheasants Forever. They subscribe and everything. And Mr. Lamp's a big guy. And what I loved about, like, the Lamp family is they're – because to be completely honest, you know, poor kid from small town, it's like to hunt, you have to have a lot of the equipment. Like, just going to be honest. But the Lamp family were big boys. So when you go hunting with Jim Lamp, it's like, dude, like, we have Cabela's downstairs. So just come downstairs and pick out whatever you want. You know, even the shotgun I have now that I'm using for, you know, clay shooting and stuff like that. He's just like, oh, no, don't buy a shotgun. I'm like, here, I got like 18 shotguns. Just take this guy.
Hmm.
You know, like that's the heart of Jim Lamp, right? He just wants to have fun and show people the love of the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ryan and I, you know, Lambert and I, we would go out and we'd go fish. You know, we're in college, yeah, we fish the Mississippi. We always joked about, you know, when we had problems, especially girl problems, you take it to the river, you know? You take it to the river, just cast it out. You know, every time we cast, we're like, yeah, this is our problems. We're casting it out to the river, you know? Especially with a lot of girl problems, you know, growing up in college. And we joke about that. Even now, as we're adults, and you know, he's got kids, he's got family. He's like, I gotta take some stuff to the river, man. We just, you know, and when I first went hunting for pheasant, we went, you know, in a pheasant farm, and Mr. Lamp was like, hey, come down, and you know, they Lamp is from the Milwaukee area, Oconomowoc, and Mr. Lamp, you know, had like there was like a hunting like a pheasant farm type, you know,
sure.
And he's like, hey, come on down, and that was my first experience, right? It was in college, and it was so incredible. It was like the funnest introduction to pheasant hunting, right? So it's like, okay, I always thought their dogs are just their dogs, but he's like, no, these are you know, pheasant dogs or hunting dogs. And I'm like, wait, what? And Mr. Lamp, he's such a generous man. He literally was like, okay, like he gave us like a 10-minute lowdown, like for us, like, and again, you're in college, so you don't want to act like you don't know anything, but I didn't know anything, right? Because we never hunted this way. It was go sit outside by a tree, you know, in the woods, and the squirrel comes, shoot the squirrel, don't talk to dad, you know, like, you know, that was simple, right? Yeah. It was just like, shh, no, you're scared the squirrel away or whatever. So we're out there, and he's just like, okay, look at the dog. The dog's going to lead us, and he'll listen to me. You know, he's like, the dog will always listen to me. Look at the dogs, and look at their nose. I mean, these are pointers. Like, watch where their nose goes. Okay, when they stop, we stop. He's like, okay, cool. Watch where their nose is, and then they're going to flush them out. Okay, when they and then he's like, okay, this is how we're gonna stand, you know, or this is how we're gonna walk.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and you know, and they had all the gear, you know, they had all the overalls and everything. So like, I was warm and I had boots and everything, you know, and so we're out there, and literally it was like, okay, just you know, be aware of your barrel, you know, like we're gonna be spread out, you know, and Mr. Lampo said, don't shoot the pheasant if they're like just kind of on the ground. Like, make sure they get air, you know? And it's like, okay, great. And I remember the first pheasant I shot, it just like inside, right? It's like, you know, dog points, boom, goes, flush it out, boom. And then we all kind of like, you know, in unison, like kind of swing, and it's like, boom, boom, boom. And I thought it was like Mr. Lamp who got it, or, you know, Ryan. And he's like, you got that one, yeah. And I'm like, and inside, I mean, I felt like I was a 5-year-old boy again, catching his first fish, right? Like, look, dad, like I can do it. And it was just like, this is incredible. From there, I learned about what it meant to have, you know, like land conservation, like how we have to protect some of these lands while these, you know, kind of these wild animals, they're a part of it. Like, you know, and from there, it got me more into like, oh, that's why we can't just like, yeah, build a highway through here. Oh, we'll just build this. Or, yeah, we'll dig this up for this, you know, mineral, whatever, blah, 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 blah over here. Oh, we're going to do this pipeline over here. I, you know, there's a lot of political stuff behind that. So I can't speak to any of that, but I understand what it feels like to be like going out into a world that's not yours and being accepted. Like, that's my biggest thing. Here's this monk kid who's out with his, you know, his friends who are all white, and his dad, you know, Jim Lamp, who is just so open arms. Hey, kid, come on. I got you. Don't worry. You know, that's why when Lamp got when he got married, we were all there at his wedding, and we just like, you know, his dad was like, yeah, you guys are just all like sleeping in our basement. You know, that's why, you know, he like Mr. Lamp till today, he's got a hunting lodge in central Wisconsin area. He invites us out. He goes, hey, you want to shoot stuff? You guys want to come out? Come out to the hunting lodge. You know, that's why, like, for me, it's like even writing that story, like, it's very important that I write that in there going, look, the Lamb family owed us nothing, owed me nothing. It wasn't like a, oh, hey, we're going to reach out to this kid who looks different than us, blah, blah, blah. No. It was a love of hunting, love for the outdoors, and says, I don't care what you look like. I don't care who you are. I don't care where you come from. Come join us.
Yeah.
It was the first time I really felt like you're accepted to a different tribe.
Yeah.
Huh. You know? And
it was through pheasant hunting.
It was through pheasant hunting. It was the most exciting thing. And then from there on, like, I got to get into duck hunting and, you know, and by the way, duck hunting in the blind is awesome. And then we went, like, for Pharaoh, we went goose hunting. And they have, like, the fancy, you know what I'm talking about? Like, the bougie blinds. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like all heated. You can literally be in there cutoffs and shorts and, you know.
Scrambling.
It's like a whole thing, but then you sit on in there, you still feel pretty cool coming out. I remember I missed a goose at a geese, you know, that had a tag on. I didn't know what that meant. Man, I did not live that down with all my buddies hunting. Like, you missed one with the tag? Like, you missed one with the ring? And I'm like, I don't know what you guys are talking about, guys. And you know, stuff like that where it was like I felt so accepted into their tribe, into their world, and they didn't care who I was.
Yeah.
And it was like, we want to show you guys how fun this is for us. Yeah. And from there, I understand, I started wrapping my head around, you know, land conservation. And then I remember I asked my mom once, I said, hey, mom, what's monk food? And my mom said, it's balance. When you look at monk food, you look at the food that we do, you look at all the flavors and everything, it's all about balance, right? One flavor is never above another. One flavor is never valued more than another. If you look at monk food, if you come to our restaurant, there's always going to be rice, some kind of protein, some kind of vegetable, and some kind of sauce. Mom says out of those four elements, one is never better than the other. If you think about that, so I'll be like, you know, Mom, like, so what does that mean? And as I start thinking about it, it's an ecosystem. We need each other.
Yeah.
Mom, especially with their farm and garden that they have up here in Scandia, it's about, 8 acres? And all the produce that comes from it goes to the restaurant. They don't ask for money. You know, they just kind of want, you know, Mom always says, you know, for about 40 years now, you know, so I'm 40 now, my hands have always taken you. Until the day the Lord takes me away, my hands will always take care of you. And so she's out there right now, you know, like right now, literally right now, working that field, making sure that we have enough produce to get us through the harvest season, you know. And so I was like, well, Mom, like, you know, explain this to me. And she goes, well, we have to take care of the land. If we take care of the land takes care of us. That's conservation.
Yeah, it is.
That's what it is. But she was talking about food and gardening and farming. But I was like, wow, Mom just gave me the ethos for land conservation.
Right.
From the mountains of Laos, that she was a little girl, learned how to farm and learn how to grow things, to Scandia, Minnesota, you know, 15 minutes from here. She just explained to me.
Right.
Exactly what land conservation meant. But she was doing it from the view and from the lens of farming and food.
Yeah.
And even within the food we do for monk food, people always ask me, what's monk food? And I said, monk food is not a type of food. If you want to say, is monk food a certain type of food? No, monk food draws from all these different cultures that we've gleaned from or that we rub shoulder with. What is monk food? Well, monk food is a philosophy. It's a way of thinking about food. Well, what is that philosophy? Well, that philosophy is that we have a living world around us, and we can take, we can harvest, we can, you know, take from that living world, give back to that living world, and use food as a vessel to just not nourish our bodies, but rejuvenate our souls. And so that's the philosophy. If you think about monk food, no matter where our people went in history, they found a way. They always found a way as long as there was dirt under their feet.
Yeah.
That's what I love about our people. And that's why when I speak to young monk kids at high schools, especially monk kids who are like, I don't, you know, I'm monk, I feel different, you know. I go, no. Don't you dare feel that way. Because do you know who your father is? Do you know who your grandfather is? Do you know that these are warriors? That when the CIA and the American government said, we need warriors to fight for us in northern Laos, in the mountains. You know, there's a CIA case study that you can read that says the reason why they chose the monk people for three reasons. One, they know the land here really well because their people lives up here. Two, they're ferocious fighters. They'll never quit. They'll never back down. And three, their cardio is incredible because they live in the mountains. That's what the CIA caseworker wrote down. Huh. Said that's why we picked the Hmong people up here. That's why we want the Hmong people to fight for us. So that warrior's blood that your grandfather, your great-grandfather, that fought for this country before they were even allowed citizenship in this country, to my young Hmong brothers and sisters, I want to tell them that blood flows in your vein. So don't you dare say you can't do anything. Don't you dare say, oh, that's impossible. No. Like my father, his father, his brothers, you know, their brothers, they fought for this country, came into this country, got rejected by this country while dumb neighbors will come by and say, go back to your own country, not knowing they fought for the country that these neighbors are living in.
Right.
Right?
It's like you're talking to your adolescent self.
Absolutely.
Too, because you articulated it a little while ago. It's like, I didn't want to be Hmong.
Oh,
and now
sure.
It's a badge of honor for you.
It is. I think that I'm just a boy trying to go back to rewrite the wrongs that I felt like I did, you know. You know, people always, I get emotional, but people always ask me like, you know, yeah, like, you know, like why would you want to build another restaurant when the restaurant world's so hard? And after COVID, you know, I had this media guy ask me and goes, dude, you could have bailed out on V9 and it's okay. Everyone, man, like you've been on TV, you've done this, right? And we always said V9 is a love letter to my mom and dad. And I think about my father, like he never gave up on us. He never gave up on us. You know, before my grandma died, she told me, your father's a war hero. After the war, he was a hero, well known. He had a great name. and he could have stayed in Thailand. He could have had a nice little plot of land and a farm somewhere in the mountains. Could have lived that life as a hero, but he didn't, you know. And my mom told me probably last year. It says your father said to me, you guys never knew this, but you were still a baby. And the night before we came to this country, before we left Thailand, before we left Vinai to come to this country, your father said to me, said, I want to go to a country where my sons and daughters can write their own destiny.
Oh.
And so when I think about that, and that really resonates inside of me, why didn't you give up on this dream? Why did it cost you so much money? Because dad never gave up. Like, he doesn't raise sons and daughters who give up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so when you look at him, which he's a 70-year-old dude, I would say he's a 70-some-year-old dude, 72, 73-year-old dude, who his biggest joy in life, dude, is to sit and his couch and have all, they got 20 grandkids, you know, all the way from, you know, in their 30s all the way to like one.
Hmm.
And watch some of the young grandkids, they just crawl all over him. He's a grandpa.
Yeah.
Like an old warrior who's fought all his battles.
Yeah.
And now he gets to sit and just hang out with his children's children.
Yeah.
And it's peace.
Yeah.
There's no more wars. There's no more fighting. It's just peace. And still in that, he chooses to wake up at 5 a.m. and go work the farm so that we have produce for our restaurant.
Yeah. So to connect a few dots for folks that maybe haven't tied the thread together, Vinai mm-hmm. was the name of the camp in Thailand mm-hmm. where you were born
mm-hmm.
and where they lived. And
yep.
You mentioned as a homage to your parents, mm-hmm. you're naming this restaurant that mm-hmm. is set to open any day now, right?
Yeah.
Vinai.
Yeah.
Spell it for us.
V-I-N-A-I. So if you go
V-I-N-A-I, on... V-I-N-A-I, mm-hmm. and there's a website.
Yep, V-N-I-M-N, as in Minnesota.com. You know, in social media, it's, you know, it's Instagram's at V-N-I-M-N.com. The thing we say about it is V-N-I, when it comes to, you know, just, you know, people who aren't from the Hmong community, mm-hmm. they're a little like, wait, what does that word mean? Does it mean something in your family? Does mm-hmm. it have a special meaning in your family? And I say, no, V-N-I is the refugee camp. But if you talk about the word V-N-I in Hmong families, we all know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows. It's either, oh, my grandparents came from that, you know. One of our chefs, one of our cooks, Hmong kid, and, you know, we started talking about V-N-I, and he goes, dude, did you know, like, my mom just talked to me that her and, like, my grandparents, like, came from that camp.
Mm.
I'm like, yeah, because from 75 to 92, it hosted 90,000 refugees.
Wow.
90,000 refugees. So it's not a camp like this little, like, you know, tent pop-up area we're in right now, you know.
No.
Like, this is, I mean, like, when I say camp, I mean, like,
yeah.
It's a village.
Yeah.
You know, so from 75 to 92... to it held 90,000 people came through it. 90% of them were Hmong, and out of the 90%, majority ended up here in the Midwest.
Wow.
So in the metro here, in the Twin Cities metro here, we have about 92,000 Hmong people that wow. live in this metro. So it's the largest concentration of Hmong people, you know, in the world.
Yeah.
And so when we say that, Hmong people know.
Mm.
They get it. They know what that name means. They know where it comes from.
Cool.
And we love that. You know, we love that. And we love being able to help educate, to help tell the story of what this place means.
Yeah.
So we always talk about, when it comes to V-N-I, the restaurant, you know, people always ask, well, what's the concept? It's like, it's a restaurant. You come in, we make food, and you guys eat it, right?
Yeah.
But I always tell people V-N-I, the restaurant, you know, like, if you look in human history, if you look at understanding the souls of people, what is the one thing that all humans across the world, doesn't matter what you believe, where you come from, your socioeconomic background, what's the one thing that we can connect on? Suffering, pain, and hurt. Everybody knows that.
Mm.
You know, not it's not like, oh, this, you know, Republican, rich, white guy hurts different than the poor, you know, whatever, Democrat, blah, 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 blah guy. You know what I'm saying? Like, no. Like, we all know that. Pain, hurt, you know. And our soul, what does all our soul yearn for? Restoration.
Mm.
So I literally one day when we were going to open, when we start the idea of the restaurant, I actually literally wrote a love letter to my mom and dad.
Mm.
Never showed them, but I wrote it and I gave it to our architect. And I said, hey, this is the letter. If I can do this I'm a literal person. Letter, this is the letter. And they looked through that letter and I looked through that letter and the word that popped out to me was restored.
Mm.
What is the human heart? Doesn't matter who you are in the world, all through the dawn of time. What is the human heart searching for? Restoration.
Mm.
Rest. That's where the word restaurant comes from.
Mm.
The word restaurant is an old French word that means restored. So back in the olden days, you know, back in the medieval times and days, when people were traveling through villages, what did they do? They needed a place to rest. So they found a place where it was like, oh, I can. There's a barn back here. I can put my horse back here, right? A stall back here for my horse. And there's a place in an inn that I can sleep in. But downstairs on the first floor would be the kitchen for the house, you know, because the people who ran that inn lived there too.
Yeah.
But then you would kind of come in their living room and, you know, for a few coins, they'll make you a bowl of soup with a little day-old bread. And that started restaurants. If you think about what restaurants really mean, it means restored. Mm. Come here, weary souls. That's what Vinai is about. Yeah. Vinai, the refugee camp, was a place of restoration for refugees.
Mm.
Vinai, the restaurant, the epicenter, the heart of it, is a place where we want people to come in, eat, and be restored.
So, and find balance.
And absolutely. So right? If we have a couple who's coming in and says, man, this week was tough. We just need, you know, we just want 45 minutes, just, you know, mom and dad time, whatever, just mm-hmm. couple time. You can come in 45 minutes. We'll get you some really great cocktails and some really great, you know, bites to eat. And in 45 minutes, you can get back to the sitter.
Mm.
Why? Because it's that 45 minutes. Let's help restore that 45 minutes. You know, let's bring a little restoration. You know, if you want to come in and say, it's time to celebrate, you know, so-and-so is graduating, we have this big table. It's my buddy Jordan and Megan, they have a design company. They built this table. It's a 10, we can fit 10 people around that table. That table represents what it means to be part of Vinai. Hmm. That table it has this deep meaning to all of us. So you can come in, resi out that table, and you can ball out. You can just ball out, eat until your heart's desire. Don't care about what the bill is.
Uh-huh.
You know, just come in and we'll take care of you. If you need a 3-hour restoration, we got you.
So yeah. For folks, again, this is opening this summer.
Yes.
Yep. So your menu is going to be new to everybody. What do you point an audience of bird hunters and you know, outdoors folks towards if – you know, maybe they're listening from Minnesota or they're coming through the Twin Cities. What would any particular entree?
So if you're a meat eater, we got some really good meats, right? So we have this like long rib, like beef rib, like this, you know, this soup, this stew, you know, and I mean, that's going to be hearty. You know, we got this double cut pork chop. Man, it's just, I mean, like when we did it, we're just like, okay, cool. And then like we start eating and we're like, guys, like this is legit, you know. We get this big long like strip loin, you know, like where you get your New York strip on, and then we take Maggi sauce, you know, what we use for the fried rice, and we mix it with salt, right?
Yeah.
So it's like almost like a sand, right? Wet sand, and then we cover it and we let it sit for 5 to 7 days, and that permeates that deep umami permeates inside, and then we shave it off, and then we take off some of that fat cap, and then we render that down to this delicious like salty tallow, and then we grill off this 16-ounce, like, I mean, if one person wants to eat it, you can go at it, but it's like made for 2 to 3, right? We grill that bad boy off, and then we just, while we're grilling, we're just like basting it with that its own fat, you know, and we, you know, a lot of stuff, like we spent the extra money to have a wood fire grill in there, because Hmong food is from wood fire, like a lot of meats, a lot of things is over wood fire. So it's an homage to my father who taught me how to cook food over the fire. We have this wood fire grill. Now our wood fire is a little fancier than the, you know, the little spot we had back in our backyard growing up. It's a little fancier, but man, it's incredible. You know, and if you're an outdoors dude, like, we'll have a bunch of wild games. We work with one of the guys that was on Feral. He has a place called Broken Arrow Ranch down in Central Texas area there, and you know, we work with them. You know, we've been dorking out with some of this like antelope and axis deer, you know, one of the dishes that we're getting from some of the meats that we're getting from them. We got a duck dish that it's kind of a secret menu dish, but it's, man, it's fun. I mean, I'll just tell you, it's secret, but whatever. Literally, we get this duck that's from like upstate area. It's a cross between a Peking duck and a Rohan duck. So it's like fatty, you know, like it's fatty, it's thick. And so we do it in different ways. We comb feed the leg, the breast, we let it age, and then we break it down and we slice it, you know, put it in front of you, and you'll have like all the accoutrements. You can make lettuce wraps out of it. You can sticky rice. And then with the neck, because we told them we want to keep the neck on, we take the bone out of the neck. And so you have all that fatty neck, right?
Yep.
and with that duck head, and then we take egg roll stuffing and we stuff it inside the neck. So think about an egg roll wrapper, but the wrapper is duck skin.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and then we roast that and we slice it out, and you know, you get this like, you know, you get this beautiful like fatty duck skin around the side, but inside is stuffed with mom's egg roll recipe, you know. So I mean, stuff like that where it's like, this is Hmong food. You know, but we get to use, you know, like I always tell people, the canvas is the same, but we get to choose what kind of paint we want to paint on it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think so many people go, well, that's not Hmong food because it doesn't look like this. When I'm like, you know, even Hmong people always say to us, that's not Hmong food because it doesn't look like this. This is what Hmong food is. I'm like, then you're imaginationless.
Mm.
Go deeper. Like I really firmly believe, and this is kind of how my parents taught us, was like, we don't want you guys to come to this country and just do the status quo. We want you to come to this country so you can dream. Mm. What is dreaming? Dreaming is imagining. How do you imagine? You learn things. That's how imagination works. If you can't imagine something, that means you don't know something. But once you start knowing, you can imagine.
Mm. You can start dreaming.
Yeah. And then doing – and all of that under the umbrella of doing this to honor their legacy.
Yeah,
I'm a firm believer of legacy. That's where I think that conservation comes into. It's just that legacy thing, you know. Why do we work hard for land conservation? Because it's a legacy, so we can pass it down from generation to generations, so that when great-great-great-grandfather was hunting on this land, so is the great-great-great-grandsons and daughters are hunting on this land. This part of the river, this part of the lake, why do we come out here all the time? Well, great-great-great-grandfather, this is what he did, and he shared it down and down and down. That's one of the greatest things I get to see in some of my buddies who are outdoorsmen, and they get to take watching their dad take their sons out. So grandpa's taking grandkid, you know, out fishing for panfish in this lake where he took him out to fish for panfish. You know what I'm saying? Like things like that. That's legacy, man. That's not legacy stuff. That's the stuff that matters. And I think about that a lot as we're building the menu, as we're building the restaurant, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, that's – I don't know. I think I see it all connecting.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you did a beautiful job connecting the dots in the story that you wrote about that first pheasant hunting experience with the Lampe family and how you talked about how – and you wrote about how that first pheasant hunt connected the bird to your perspective on the land and how we treat the land through conservation is so important to what ends up on your table, whether it's in your home or at your restaurant. And you just connected those dots beautifully in that story. For folks, I'll remind you one more time. Yia has a story in the Upland Bird Hunting Super Issue. It's already in the mail if you're listening to this. It's in the mail. So if you're not a member right now, that's okay. Become a member. Drop me an email, bobs@pheasantsforever.org. I will send you a copy with Yia's story and his pheasant fried rice recipe, which we just got done filming. You missed the deadline, but that's okay. We want you to get this. It's our biggest issue of the year. Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever merged together for this one super issue. And like I said, Yia's story is in there. The video's online as a companion to this podcast. And again, you can email me at bobs@pheasantsforever.org, and I'll get it for you. Closing thoughts, Yia. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I think, you know, as we started this, I talked about how sincere you are, and there's been a couple of moments during this conversation where, like, it was just dripping with sincerity when you were talking about balance and in the Hmong culture and the food, and you're talking about your parents and how rest is like the first component of a restaurant, you know. I wish you nothing but the success with this restaurant. Tell folks again how to find the restaurant, and then also how to follow you on Instagram.
Yeah, so we have a couple restaurants. You know, we have Union Hmong Kitchen, which is kind of like our firstborn.
Yeah.
A fussy firstborn there. So we have a location up in Uptown. In Minneapolis. We just call it Lake Street, you know, Union Hmong Kitchen Lake Street. We have another one in North Loop. So it's at Gray's Food Hall. So Union Hmong Kitchen there. There we get to do, it's a smaller footprint. So we do rice bowls there. If you guys are listening to this and you're from Minnesota, the Minnesota State Fair, this will be our third year in the Minnesota State Fair. So we have a stall there at the International Bazaar. We have these little stalls, one at the Twin Stadium one at.
You got one at Target Field, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, one, cool. One Target Field. Yeah,
you there's get, your baseball shout. I yeah, used yeah. to work at baseball, so there's yep. almost always a baseball yep. shout out.
Yeah,
in the podcast.
Yes, yep, yep. That's a Target Field. That's it's been amazing there. We use the Hmong sausage and we use it as a balmy brat.
Oh,
we
wow. call it.
Yeah, yeah. There, and then we have another one at Allianz Field, and we have like a noodle salad there. And then this will be our second year at the Viking Stadium.
Okay,
you
know, like US Bank Stadium.
Yeah, yeah, US Bank Stadium. So you know, we kind of been
you're
very
all
blessed.
Over the place well, more than I even knew.
Well, we have some really great operators who run that for us, and then. And then, you know, Vinai is on 2nd Ave Northeast, which is right where we share an alleyway with Young Joni right there in Northeast and right across the street from our good friends, Oro. You know, we're some of the best Mexican food / you want some good mezcal drinks. That's, you know, that's where you hit it up. So we'll be right there in that little corner there. And we're excited. We are a few weeks. Weeks more weeks out.
By the time this comes out, we'll be even closer.
Okay, yeah, for sure. And so that's what we're doing. And we, you know, have a few projects in the works. And then, third season of Feral drops end of September.
Cool.
Yeah, and then I'm excited about some of those. Like, I went noodling. I never thought that I'd ever go noodling for catfish. And let me tell you, like, I respect the guys who do it. I think the family we went with, it was incredible. But it's like when I say, oh, yeah, we're in Oklahoma, like central Oklahoma-ish area, and we're noodling in this river that literally looks like chocolate milk.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, like I get a certain image of a certain kind of people in your head. I'm like, oh, you're right. Yeah, completely. Like, you're right. Like, your bias actually helps you. But it was such a fun thing, you know. And, man, there's nothing scarier than having your hand in some deep hole than having to drop your whole body under and reaching your hand in and just hoping that it's not a snapping turtle,
uh-huh.
you know, and that, you know, when that first bite of that catfish right on your hand, you're just like, whoa, and you're down in the water struggling. And then all you have to do is, okay, you can't let it spin because it can break your wrist. And oh my gosh, I was just... I had to jack myself up a little bit before doing that, you know.
Man, I cannot believe how much stuff you got going on.
Oh, you know.
You are a busy dude.
Well, I will say this. I have an incredible team, Bob. Like, they're freaking awesome. You know, they allow me to do what I get to do because they're great at what they do, you know. And so it is, you know, we've worked through a lot of problems. We worked through issues. And the biggest thing I say to all our team is this: there's no problem too big that if we don't, that when we put our heads together, we can't solve together, you know. Work the problem, move forward, work the problem, move forward. And man, when you have a team who believes in that, you know, and the thing that we always say to each other in the morning, you know, I have two teams in the morning, we text and we just, you know, text through Slack or whatever and communicate with them. The last thing that we created in our restaurant culture, the last thing we say to, like, we always say, hey, this is kind of what I'm doing for the day. This is what I'm doing for the day. And the last thing that we say to each other and we say is, how can I support you?
Mm.
This is my day. This is what I'm doing. But even through my days, how can I support you? Like just this morning as I'm driving here, you know, there was a shortage on some kind of flour. And, you know, one of our younger chefs like, hey, we're out of this, you know, but we need this today to, you know, make this dough. And I'm driving down here and I'm, you know, I text, you know, one of our director of operations, it's his day off. So I was like, we don't want to mess with him. So, you know, I text another chef and goes, hey, man, can you run real quick and grab this? Yep, got it. You know, and he was at the doctor's office. He goes, okay, once I get out here, I'm going to go grab that. Awesome. It's that idea. How do I support you? Mm. Even though my day's filled, your day's filled, it's never kind of like, well, I'm doing this. What are you doing? It's no, we both know that our days are filled, but how do I support you? And I think a lot of that came, and we reflect a lot of that from mom and dad. Like growing up, they were busy. They did a lot of things, but at the end of the day, they can still say to us, how can I support you? What can I do for you? You know? And so that's kind of the echo of our work culture is saying, how can I support you? Instead of saying, do you know what I've done today? Do you know what I'm saying? Like just changing that mentality where we all trust that everyone is busy. We have things that we're doing. We're all great operators. So there's no sense of feeling of like, I want to show you how great I am or I want to show you how great I am. And that's what when we get young chefs that work for us and they just want to prove themselves. And I always say, I hope, buddy, stop. Here's the deal. You're already here. You got the job. You're working in the kitchen. You're leading in this area. You have your station. You got the job. We believe in you.
Mm.
You don't got to prove anything. You're going to make mistakes. But you know what? This restaurant, there's space for grace. Don't hide your mistakes. Bring it to the light. when you bring your mistakes to light, we can all be creative and say, how do we fix this together? Mm. You know, we always say, what kind of people we look for to work within our company, we work within our restaurant group. And the acronym is FAT, F-A-T. Faithful, shows up on time, does what they're supposed to, knows the task at hand. A, it's accountable. Be accountable for your actions. Accountability is not a bad word. If you make a mistake, say you made a mistake. I make a mistake. I'm like, guys, I messed up on this. Accountability. And T, teachable. Faithful, accountable, teachable. That's all we're asking, you know? And so, yeah, it took a long time to kind of develop that culture. And what we find real quick of the people who come in and we're like, well, that's just not for me. So it's like, okay, cool. Like, you know, then it's not for you. There's no right or wrong in that. There's no good or bad, you know? And, you know, they move on to different things. And, but for us, it's like, that's what we, you know, that's the core of what we want to do. And so again, incredible team. Like, that's why they're doing the stuff that you're doing today, so that, you know, on a Monday morning I can come here and do this, and I love it. So it's not worried, like, okay, I'm like texting back, oh, what's going on, you know? And so, yeah, dude, we're very, very blessed. And that's why our mantra, one of the things we always talk about, is like, always moving forward together. You know, we're always moving. What direction? Forward. How? Together.
So I don't know your parents, but I know you bet on yourself, and I bet you they're awfully proud.
Yeah, you know, they're proud in, like, they're proud in the ways that I, because I kind of still see myself as a screw-up at times, you know what I'm saying? Because it's just like, man, I've done some really stupid stuff. You know, my dad, I think this moment changed me was last year we were doing this event. Lieutenant Governor, you know, Peggy Fellingham came in and gave us an award. And it was this big dinner that my mom and dad helped us cook. And she gave this award and she was really sweet and just say, hey, we just want to honor you with this, you know, knowing that you're one of the voices of, you know, Hmong people, blah, 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 and all that stuff. And I was able to speak at that event, you know, that we put on. And, you know, in our culture, when you have a leader of a community, like Lieutenant Governor, Governor, Mayor, who speaks highly of your child, you know, that's a great honor to the parents, you know, because for them, it's, you know, that's just the way we, our culture rolls. And I think my mom told me that after that, my dad said to my mom, he said, before we went to bed the other night, your father said to me, I want to, he said something along the lines of, like, I feel like I need to apologize to him because I just didn't know what he did. I just thought he was a cook. And he said that when he's like, I never would imagine that I would see leaders in our community, leaders in our state, and my son will speak and they will listen to them. And in our culture, like, that's huge. You know, I get real emotional thinking about this thing where my father said to me, and what I know in our culture, it's never, like, parents don't say, oh, I'm so proud of my kid publicly. But what is one of the greatest things in our culture is when other families, other parents, other leaders will come up to your parents and say, you got a good boy. Yeah. And I, you know, and I experienced that where these leaders will come up to my mom and dad, shake their hands and say, hey, you got a good boy. Like, you have a good son. And I think for my parents, that's where there's these special moments they get to keep inside of them. And that's just not me in our family. That's all their children. And that's, you know what I'm saying? And I look and I see how blessed we are as the children of them. And how I look at my siblings and they are leaders in their fields. You know, they're known within the Hmong community too. And so I love being able to share that platform with them. And just so that we all, as a whole sibling group, we get to honor our mom and dad, you know?
Well, thank you for the partnership and what you're doing to pass your traditions on to a broader audience of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever members. As you know, before we hit record, you know, we're talking about how important it is for people that haven't traditionally been part of organizations like ours to see folks like you talking about wild foods and hunting and conservation and getting involved in organizations like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And thank you for being, you know, a role model, whether or not you're comfortable with it or not. You are one, and your words carry a lot of weight, and you know, it was really, really a pleasure today.
Yeah, it's been really fun to be able to go in all these different worlds. I don't know. I'm just a naturally curious person. So to me, it's been really fun. But it's just an honor, man. Like, dude, to be a part of Pheasants Forever, being able to do this, being able to work with you guys, I mean, it is such an honor. And it is something that's like, man, you want to see some good wild games, like come to a Hmong cookout. Mm. Seriously, like that's, we're all about that, you know? Venison to, you know, different kind of fish to different, you know, to pheasant, quail, squirrels, rabbits, you know, like that's, mm. that's our wheelhouse, you know?
Do you have a favorite? What's your
squirrel? Oh my gosh.
You know, almost every single chef mm-hmm. that I ask what their favorite wild game is, mm-hmm. almost every one of them comes back to squirrel.
Well, okay, I will clarify. Squirrel, I mean like squirrels in the woods, not in like Minneapolis, because those, those guys eat diaper and they taste like, I can imagine they taste like diaper. But I'm talking about, do you know
the
what
ones that eat, you know, I know. But you're going back to it, like you are what you eat.
Yes.
Like, I remember. I think the first chef I interviewed about this was Georgia Pellegrini.
Okay.
And she's like, man, squirrels, you know, they're eating nuts and acorns.
Yeah.
And they taste buttery.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm talking about in the woods, like out here. Like I'm talking about they're loading up on acorns, walnuts, like all the good fatty acids, you know, mm-hmm. like all that omega-3. And their hindquarters, dude, it's like, what am I having here? You know, and then, you know, it's just like, and it's every part of it in that bone when you make a braise out of it. It's just so like it robust. You know, you're like, is this beef? You're not sure. Now, squirrels in the cities, they eat a little different, okay? Yeah. They eat diapers and whatever.
We don't want those.
Yeah, those we just throw rocks at and be like, get out of here, you hooligans, you know? They eat our furniture outside, or, you know, they eat our trash cans, literally, you know? But, man, you know, when mom and dad, you know, when my buddies, they shoot a couple of squirrels in the woods and they bring them, like, my parents' love language is if we can get wild game to them, like my buddies will shoot a deer and be like, hey, man, I got a doe out here. Like, you know, I'm pretty full. And I bring it to my mom and dad. That is their love language. Mm-hmm. They feel like, you know how like most, like a lot of, or not a lot, some Asian moms like, was like, oh my gosh, this is a Gucci bag. Or, oh, you got me a Louis Vuitton belt. You know, like the name brand stuff. My mom and my dad's love language is you put a deer in front of them, they're like, oh, yeah, let's go. You put some squirrel in front of them, you put some bass in front of them, some catfish in front of them, they're like, oh, yeah, you're speaking into our hearts, you know, like right there and then. And then my mom would call me later and be like, this is what we did with it. This is how we broke it down, and we invited our friends over. Wild game to my parents. Like, if you guys got wild game out there, you're like, well, we need to just move this product. Dude, you put them in their doorsteps and they're just, it's like gold. If you're giving them gold, they're like, whoa, are you serious? You're not, you know? And so we do these like holiday hunts with some of my buddies and they'll, you know, they'll shoot and they're like, yeah, our freezer are full, but man, take it over to mom and dad. Dad will break this down in 30 seconds. He's got the whole thing rigged up in his shed, breaks it down in 30 seconds. You know, he's like ready. When we got there, the whole thing was ready. I drove, you know, up from Baraboo, Wisconsin, you know, that's where we had this holiday hunt. We got this doe. My buddy shot this doe. I drove it up, you know, almost 4 hours, got there. He was ready. He was like sitting outside pacing, like, okay, when you get in? I'm like, Dad, I'm an hour out. Okay, your dad's outside waiting. Breaks that thing down like 30 minutes, starts, you know, breaking all the meat off, and mom just takes the meat, starts making food with it. I mean, that to me is like one of the most fun moments where I just tell my buddies, like, dude, you guys want to see my mom and dad be like, you guys love us? It's just, you put wild game in front of them.
That's awesome.
They'll drop it. It's so incredible. And so I love it, you know, and just even be able to like the other day, I got some farm quail and I got to them and my mom was like, this is the most delicious thing ever. Huh. Thank you so much. You know, or sometimes I'll go to the fish shop and I get whole fish and I'll bring it over, you know, some kind of whole fish like bronzini or snapper, you know, and my mom just loves it. She's like, oh, your dad loves this stuff, you know? And so that, I mean, this is like, to me, it's simple. They're so simple. You know, it's not like we need to buy them a bunch of land or big houses or whatever. They're just like, whatever, as long as we can, you know, we can just cook this for, and they always love saying, we can cook this for our grandchildren. We just want our grandchildren to have food, you know? And so that's incredible, man.
Yeah, that's fun. Well, speaking of food, you got to get back and get that restaurant open. So thank you for spending so much time with
me. Man, thanks for having me, brother.
Yeah. All right, folks. I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always follow the dog. Yeah, something good will arise, and that'll lead to a hell of a nice meal. All right, folks. Thank you.